Just to, if you don't already know, tomorrow is the full moon day in October, which ends our rains retreat. So the actual Katina always goes after the end of the rains retreat. And that means that we have a ceremony in the afternoon in Bodhinyana Monastery Hall. So from 4:30 to 6, we'll be there. The nuns have to come, so we have a little meeting, and after that, at 6 o'clock, we finish. And so tomorrow afternoon, there will not be any opportunity to have a sutta class, but we can still do any interviews between 3:30 and 4 if people need them, and everything else will be as usual. So please, I apologize that just this time of the year, we have to all come together to do our little ceremony over in Bodhinyana. And just to let you know what the ceremony is we call it like a forgiveness ceremony. So we all ask forgiveness, anything we've done over the past 3 months, by body, speech or mind, intentional or unintentional, things we didn't do, which we should have done, we ask forgiveness of each other. And that means that understanding that when you live together, and there's always something you do, something you say, which upsets somebody. Most of the time, it's totally by accident, but every now and again, you mean it. But it's just human nature. So that we take the opportunity this time just to say we forgive one another, and that means that we finish off our rains retreats. Monks go this way, that way. And so we go with a nice, clean conscience, with our freedom of our friendships. So that's one of the nice things we do at the end of a rains retreat, and that's tomorrow afternoon. Okay, so now the word of the Buddha. I've got to put my necklace on.
Oh yeah, it's off first. So we start with the word of the Buddha, Namo Tassa.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. The word of the Buddha, and we got to the point of the arising and passing away, and this is from the Satipatthana Samyutta. So he said the four nutriments, the origination and continuance of the body, and I went to mention those yesterday, food, six sense contacts, will and consciousness, and supported by the experience, again needs the six sense contacts, and supported, this is important when people already ask me, I think in one of the questions, this idea of a citta, a mind. That mind is not independent of other causes. Here it makes it very clear, supported by nama-rupa. And nama-rupa, for want of a better explanation, to keep it simple, is just the objects of consciousness. They have many different objects of consciousness. And the nama-rupa was explained pretty clearly in the Majjhima Nikaya. It was actually Sariputta taught that very clearly. But then when it went into the Abhidhamma, they gave a different definition of nama-rupa, and that has caused a lot of confusion with people. But it's much better to go to the earlier teachings. And anyway, that the earlier teachings are very consistent, that nama-rupa, the objects of consciousness, and consciousness, they describe them as
two sheaves of reeds. When farmers had threshed the rice and they had the stalks, what would become straw, they were to feed their livestock, they were to dry them, they would actually leave them just leaning against one another so the air could get through, just so one would lean against the other. And so that was a farming simile which everybody would know. You need the two to lean against each other so they could dry. And if you took one away, the other one would fall. And that was with Chitta and Namarupa. So they said, supported by Namarupa, the objects of consciousness, there is the origination of the Chitta. With the cessation of Namarupa, the Chitta ceases. So what he was saying very clearly there, this thing we call the Chitta is not permanent. When there's an object of consciousness, then there's the Chitta. When there's a Chitta, there can be objects of consciousness. But when one goes, the other goes. They're not permanent. And lastly, supported by attention is origination of mind objects. Take the attention away, the mind objects cease. This is one of the reasons why the idea of mind objects is, you know, not bad. So, we're now going on to the second satipatthana, the mindfulness of experience. And how are you mindful of experience? Vedana. And vedana, it's a noun, it comes from a verb, vedeti. It means to experience, to feel, just to sense, in the sense of being a sensory experience, in the sense of the five, six senses, not just the five. So when it says many times that vedana is like feeling, and there's three types of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or in between, that is just like, you know, saying, I've mentioned this before, like humanity, you know, or like Buddhism. There's three types of Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, and Hahayana. So it doesn't really matter. This is Buddhism, the different types of Buddhism. This is just experience we're talking about here, to be mindful of experience. And yeah, there's the different types of experience. But what we're really talking about here is this thing we call, you know, the experience. So being mindful of experience, you understand why this is not just mindful of, you know, and worrying or noting whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or in between, but just getting to know this thing which we call, you know, experience for any of the six senses. Now, what is knowing? Now, what is sort of feeling in the body? Now, what is seeing? Hearing? How does it all work? So this is why the mindfulness of it is like we are scientists aware, gaining information so that we can understand, you know, this thing which consumes our life, experience. So, in particular, first of all, this whole satipatthana, it begins with having restrained the five hindrances, mindful, aware of the purpose, energized, that we are mindful of this thing which we call experience. And as I mentioned, we have to restrain those five hindrances first, otherwise that we see what we want to see, we hear what we want to hear, we're in denial to things which we just don't like. So that is one of the reasons why the five hindrances have to be abandoned, or at least restrained, and then you're energized. So, when feeling a pleasant experience, you are mindful, you feel a pleasant experience. When feeling an unpleasant experience, you are mindful, you feel an unpleasant experience. When feeling a neutral experience, you are mindful that you feel a neutral experience. Doesn't that sound like when breathing in a long breath, when breathing in a short breath? This is just to get a handle on what experience is, to give you something to know what experience it is. Because some experiences are pleasant, really pleasant, extremely pleasant, just a tiny bit pleasant, Well, just ordinary, you can't say they're pleasant or unpleasant. Sometimes they're both pleasant and unpleasant at the same time. Just depends which way you look at them. And so sometimes they're unpleasant, really unpleasant. They're unpleasant, but they're good for you. And so there's all sorts of combinations. What we're really saying is we're just aware of this thing we call experience and how it works. And what we also have here, which is interesting, that we also know the difference between a pleasant worldly experience and a pleasant unworldly experience. They call it niramisa sukha, which means it's got nothing really to do with stuff, possessions, acquisitions, which is a very good way the Buddha, this was obviously a very common description, isn't it? Worldly nice experiences and there's worldly unpleasant experiences, worldly pleasant experience and unworldly pleasant experiences. So not all pleasant experiences, you know, are to be abandoned. So the pleasant experiences which you are supposed to cultivate in meditation are those such as inspiration, first of all. So you hear a very good Dhamma talk, you read the suttas, you see somebody doing something amazing, and it gives you like inspiration. And an example of that, continuing on to stories of the weird and wonderful, which I was saying last night, because people love those. There was, in Sydney, apparently Ajahn, I got this from Ajahn Sujato, but he wouldn't tell me the name, and I don't want to press the name of this monk, and I don't want you to ask him either the name of this monk, because this monk was teaching a meditation retreat, and when, you know how the meditation retreats start, you know, you get your briefing first of all, and then here you come into the hall, and the schedule was a half an hour meditation, and then he would give the opening talk about 8 o'clock, and then everyone would go to bed, and then carry on the following morning. So that he was meditating in there, and when it got time for the talk at 8 p.m, he was still meditating. And 8:30, he was still meditating. And, you know, being an Asian community, no one sort of tapped him on the shoulder or just nudged him and said, "Hey mate, time to give a talk, come on." They were far too respectful to do things like that. So they just waited and waited and waited. And of course, when it got to 9 p.m. and he still hadn't come out from his meditation, they just all went to bed. And in the morning, when they came up for the morning meditation and maybe some chanting, he was still sitting there. He hadn't moved. He stayed there all night. And so, you know, they're waiting for the chanting, he was still meditating. Sort of when the breakfast came, they didn't wait for any gong, they were out there having the breakfast. And he was still meditating there. And the morning talk, he was still meditating. Lunch, he was still meditating, so they just had their lunch. He sat there for 8 days. He never moved. Never ate anything. Never went to the toilet. Never drank anything. For 8 days. Just sat there like a Buddha statue. And when his meditation finished, the retreat hadn't ended yet, he came out of his meditation, and the first thing he did was to apologize, ask forgiveness of everybody. I'm really sorry, I just got into a nice deep meditation, and this time just didn't have any meaning, and I just was sitting there. And I'm sorry I didn't give you any talks. And all the people there said, "No, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." It was so inspiring. The inspiration which they saw from somebody who could meditate sort of, no, for 8 days, and they were all there seeing it, was, and the energy they got, maybe some energy from his deep meditation, was just so wonderful. They said, "Don't apologize at all. That was an amazing teaching which you gave us. Invaluable." So you can see that was an example of unworldly happiness, which everybody shared in, to see such a monk sort of do such a thing. So that's where you get inspiration, and it's that is something to really indulge in, because it does lead to deep meditation. It does lead, obviously, to increase in confidence and faith that this path is something really amazing. And you can actually feel the peace and the happiness and the wisdom come into your mind. It's inspiring. That happiness should be encouraged. It's called unworldly happiness. And the other unworldly happiness is you know, when you keep your precepts, it's wow, amazing. You actually feel good. You feel happy. You know, you wonder, why do all these people break precepts and stuff? What are they doing that for? It's 44 years now since I put on a brown robe, and people say, aren't you tired of keeping all those precepts? You know, don't you want to let loose? What? The what? The card?
Yeah, from the office.
Nah, it's but sometimes you think, no, what do you want to do that for? Because after so many years as a monk, your precepts are just natural. They're just what you do, or rather what you don't do. And you think, what would I want to do that for? You know, breaking anything. So it was just a natural happiness, inspiration you get from precepts. And from generosity and kindness. Oh, it's just, you know, some of the greatest acts of generosity. One of those greatest acts that I was sweeping the hall in, this was in Thailand, Wat Nanachat. And I was just going behind a cupboard when I heard somebody come in. I thought it was a thief, because it wasn't like an ordinary person. They were looking around and they didn't see me. And I wondered what they're doing. And I was just peeking, you know, just to see what they're up to. They never saw me. And it was the young girl in the village who, I'm not quite sure what the disability was, but, you know, she could not speak. She could only grunt. She never could get to school. And it was what was amazing, because she was born in the village, grew up in the village, the people of her age, her friends, could understand every grunt, knew what it meant, because they'd grown up. It was like a special language. And they'd always take her to celebrations and parties. She would never be institutionalized or separated from anybody. And I thought it was a wonderful way of dealing with those, you know, people who are disabled for one reason or another. But she came in alone to the temple. I wondered, what the heck was she doing? And I just peeked and peered without letting her see me. And when she thought that she was alone and no one was watching her, she went up to the shrine and she put something on the shrine in front of the Buddha. She bowed 3 times and she ran out before someone could catch her. And when I went out to see what she put on there, she made like a paper lotus. And it was, no, she was disabled. It wasn't sort of a work of art in the sense you could put that in a museum. You could probably do a much better little folded lotus like that. But, you know, she was so embarrassed that someone would think it wasn't good enough. That's why she crept in and put it on the shrine as her offering to the Buddha, and then ran out. And when I saw that, it was one of the greatest acts of generosity I've ever had the privilege to witness. And I told the monks, I wasn't at the senior monk, I was just a junior monk doing a duty. I told them what had happened. And I said, if anyone tries to remove that lotus, they might see another side of Ajahn Brahm. And I think they all accepted. It was a beautiful act of generosity from someone who couldn't give anything except just the best she could do, a little paper lotus, which she put up there. And for me, it wasn't just what it looked like. or how much it costs. It's where it came from. That's generosity. But anyway, so that meant that that's unworldly happiness. And that unworldly happiness, please be aware of it, be mindful of it, inspiration, kindness, the old little acts of kindness when someone, you know, realizes you haven't gone out for breakfast, then they bring you some breakfast to your room. Well, little acts of, you know, kindness, monks' birthdays. Mm-hmm. Well, what you said about, we're supposed to have left the world. It makes you happy. It brings a bit of joy to the meditation retreat. Why not? And when you do things like that, it brings up your energies. And you find your meditation gets much better when you allow unworldly happiness to come up. If it's, yay, I've won the lotto today, I'm rich. That's not unworldly happiness, that's pretty worldly. So anyway, oh, I got a promotion at work, yay. Or, you know, the boss I don't like has left. Yeah. So, but anyway, you know the difference between a worldly pleasant and an unworldly pleasant. And the same with unpleasant, a worldly pleasant experience. So a worldly unpleasant experience and an unworldly pleasant experience. Because you know sometimes that, you know, we have the, already mentioned, in the body scan, you have feelings in the body. Sensations of the body which are sometimes painful. I just already mentioned about the food poisoning, or, you know, Mandus's toothache. There's so many stuff in the body, you know, it's painful, but you can actually use it for unworldly wisdom. As you see and investigate it, so don't run away from it, but you turn it into something unworldly. And of course, the what's in between. So you know the difference between what pleasures are there to be pursued. Now the religious life, monastic life, Buddhism, is not just all misery and just suffering and endurance and being ascetic and not having any joy at all. That would just make people almost psychotic. So what it does do is actually you separate out the pleasures, the experiences which you're going to use, you know, to create inspiration, energy, peace and freedom. And those which you're going to avoid as dangerous. So this is how you learn what experience is in life. And in this way, you are aware of your own experience and what human experience is. You're aware that the experience of others is of the same nature as yours. You're not special. You know, you have the joys and the pains, the wonderful successes and the failures. And it's actually how we understand them. And then we are mindful, you are mindful of both your own and others' experiences, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of experience in the sensory contact. That's where the experience comes from. But we don't actually say in here what causes the perception of a pleasurable experience or an unpleasant experience. I can understand this because I used to take chili when I was in Thailand in the early days, a young man. But these days it just wrecks my stomach. But then I see they have these chili eating competitions. I think, what on earth are you doing? Who can eat the greatest amount of hottest chilies? And they think it's fun. I mean, there's something masochistic about, you know, eating that sort of stuff. Anyway, they do it. Why do people do those things? Why do people go to these, I've actually seen them, like these death drops in these theme parks. They turn you upside down. and really fast, and just, I don't know why people do such stuff. There's enough suffering already in this world without just, and you've got to pay money for that too. But why do people do that? You know, because what is that suffering? A lot of times, I might be wrong here because I've never been on those rides. My thing is that when you survive it, you get a rush of pleasure. It's the fact that, you know, that the pain, the fear is now overcome. It's that old saying that pleasure is the space between two moments of suffering. And suffering is the gap between two moments of pleasure. No more than that. But anyway, you get to know what sort of this experience is. And you're aware that the arising experience is sensory contact. And you're aware that the experience is of the nature to cease when sensory contact ceases. Or you're aware contemplating experiences called of nature, both arising and ceasing. Why? It's because sometimes you allow experience to cease. You know what it's like when it stops. Usually the Buddha said this, that when he was old, you know, he had an old body, he was aching and just the normal old age problems. And he said the only time he could have physical comfort was when the body disappeared, when he was in the deep meditations, when the body had gone. Or like the story yesterday of that lady in England on BBC who did a near-death experience and she didn't want to go back to her body again. It was just too unpleasant. And so it's when experience ceases, it's more pleasant. It's one of the reasons why, you know, as a monk, many years, 44, that when people invite me, do you want to go and see Niagara Falls? It was the last global conference of Buddhism that in Toronto. I'd arrived early. I think Angie had arrived early as well. She said, "Oh, I'm going over to Niagara Falls. Do you want to come?" Yeah. Angie, oh, you were there as well, yeah. And you invited me to get on the bus to go to Niagara Falls. And she drove, did she? Did she fall over the falls? Now, what do I want to go to Niagara Falls for? Just another experience. I prefer to let experience cease and be quiet, sit in meditation. Much more fun. And when I was in Las Vegas, I went to Las Vegas, but I can't tell you what I did there. You know why? Because what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. No, I just gave them talks. They said, "Do you want to see the Strip?" And I never saw the Strip. Went all the way to Las Vegas. I never saw the Strip. And so they said, "Well, how about, it's not that far to Grand Canyon?" Nah. It's just another experience, that's all. What do you want to go and see that for? So I prefer the cessation of experience rather than more experience. So when you understand what experience is, what is experience? And sometimes people call it like an irritation of the senses. An irritation. Anyway, but that's what experience is. Once you realize where it comes from and how it ceases and what it's like when it ceases, then you're mindful. It's just experience, that's all. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. Oops, where's that gone? Yeah. Press the wrong button again. Experience again. Yeah. Uh-oh. That's not where I was. Okie dokie. Somewhere. No. Oh, okay. Yes, I'm getting there. It's just on the mindful experience. Here we go. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. Especially not clinging to experience. Experience, that's all. Pleasant experience, unpleasant experience. You can't have one without the other. So that's where you you don't cling to anything. Have you got a bucket list of things you want to do before you die? I know where this bucket list idea came from. My first item on my bucket list is to have no buckets. That stops all that. Okay, the next satipatthana, the mindfulness of the citta, the mind. So that, again, having restrained the five hindrances, knowing the purpose of what you're doing. What are you doing this for? Again, it's to get this experience, understanding of the mind. You know, the canvas on which experience, you know, you may say, is drawn and painted. What is this mind? And actually, as it were, it's painted. It's an interesting concept, because citta has a second meaning in Pali and Sanskrit, meaning like beautiful, variegated. And that's why there was the Thai prince Chitra, when he came with his armies, as princes used to do in those days, and invaded north of Malaysia, what's now Malaysia, and then he founded the town of Chitra, which is a Sanskrit form of citta. And that was just because it was a beautiful place. And so they named it after him, Chitra. But anyway, how are you mindful of the mind? You understand. Straight away there's a change there. You're not mindful of the mind. You understand. Pajanati, that's like the word panya. You understand a mind that is affected by wanting as such, and a mind that is unaffected by wanting as such. What is it like to have a mind which wants something? Which is craving for something, which is not happy being here, just wants something. What's such a mind like? You understand it. What's a mind like when it doesn't want anything? When it's what you say is contented. Like a tummy which is full after a good lunch. Like you've had a good rest. Like you've finished your work, so you're on a holiday. You don't want anything. What's it like? Those moments. I always say that, imagine you were walking in Jhana Grove and you found a bottle and you rubbed it and a genie came out. And so I give you three wishes. Get lost. Excellent. If they get lost, I don't want any wishes. So could you do that? You think, well, Ajahn Brahm's not around, so can I first of all? Don't say Ajahn Brahm. So, but contemplate a mind which has no wanting at all, perfectly satisfied, content, not sort of discriminating anything in the whole world. Sunny day, cold day, time passing. You don't want anything else. Perfectly happy. Imagine what that must be like. So you're understanding that. And you understand the mind is affected by aversion as such. Why do we get averse to people? People are people. They say all sorts of things, silly things. But you always... I always say always. I did it again. Of course, that I've never had children, so I don't know what it's like to change a baby's nappies. But it's supposed to be one of the most disgusting things. But mothers do that. I'm a monk, obviously. You know that sometimes in the Thai tradition, that to bless the baby, they actually hand it to the monk first of all. You know, it's like, you know, that making me the godfather sort of thing. So they hand the baby to me, and quite honestly, I just can't get rid of it quickly enough before it poos. If it poos, I mean, the smell, the stink, and you've got a big fat nappy on, but it still gets into your robe. But mothers do that. something really, really disgusting. But, you know, you will do that without any aversion whatsoever. And that to me is wonderful, amazing. Just, you know, the love and the kindness, non-discriminatory thing. But then somebody goes up and says, you know, you're fat. And you get very upset. And sometimes it's not just the disgusting nature of what we have to experience in life, but sometimes our expectations. You know, we don't expect people to tell me I'm fat, but we're okay changing babies' nappies. So, you understand what aversion actually is. And it was a Singaporean, I don't know who it is. I can't remember them, because they came into the, it was the BF years ago, and they said, Ajahn Brahm, can you teach me the Four Noble Truths? Quickly, because I've got to go to work. And I don't mind sort of having these weird sort of experiences, because, you know, when it's something out of the ordinary, it's repeatable. You can include it in your talks. And I rose to the occasion, not all. If I didn't rise to the occasion, I wouldn't tell you it. I only tell the stories where I actually did something inspiring. When I did nothing inspiring at all, I forget those. But I said, yeah, well, suffering is asking from this world something that it can never give you. Suffering is asking from this world something it can't give you. And I think that was a pretty good explanation of the Four Noble Truths. Asking from this world what it can't give you. Expecting husbands to be always there for you. And always knowing exactly what you want. Expecting wives to be always soft and gentle, just like when you went out with them and proposed. Expecting bosses to be always sensitive to you. Sometimes, you know, you're a boss too. So sometimes we expect other people to do stuff which we don't do ourselves. Expecting your monk to always come up with new stories and new and new jokes. Expecting every meditation to be blissful. So sometimes you catch ourselves, we expect from the world what it can never give us. That's wanting. And that's also aversion. So one of the time, it's just life. It's sometimes cold, sometimes it's hot. Sometimes the dogs bark. Sometimes your husband said, I'll do it later, darling. Which means never. Oh, no. I've never been married, obviously, so I'm just stereotyping. But you understand what aversion is. And a mind unaffected by aversion. What it's like? I have no aversion at all. Just people are people. They're good fun. A mind affected by delusion as such. Hey, how can you understand a deluded mind? If you're deluded, you can't understand anything. So you say a mind that was affected. I should have put what was affected by delusion. And a mind unaffected by delusion as such, you see clearly. And what is a mind affected by delusion? It's in the power of the five hindrances. When those five hindrances are there, they delude you. You see what you want to see. And you also understand a contracted mind is contracted because of dullness and drowsiness, the onslaught and torpor. This is a little aside simile. What is sloth and torpor? What does it do to your mind? It says it contracts it, like puts it in a cell. You can't move very far. You can't go this way or that way. You're contracted and you're shrunk. That's the sloth and torpor. Or a mind distracted because of restlessness and remorse. And obviously you can understand distracted all over the place. But the idea of a contracted mind in a cell, in a small area, can't really go places. That's a very beautiful simile for sloth and torpor. And you also understand an exalted mind, surpassed mind, a still mind, a liberated mind. And they all refer to the minds in jhanas. It's exalted, surpassed. What do I mean by surpassed? It surpassed the world. A still mind and a liberated mind. All different words for the jhana states. And an unexalted, unsurpassed, not still, not liberated mind, not in jhana as such. In this way, you're aware of your own mind, citta. You're aware that others' citta is of the same nature as yours. You abide aware of both your own and others' citta. You might sort of say, oh, someone's a holy man or a holy woman. What does that mean? I mean, they got some like godlike citta. And that says, no. Human beings are human beings. You know, jitters are jitters. So we don't so discriminate between somebody who's a male or a female, or the non-binary genders. We don't sort of, and with gender is not binary anyway, we don't so discriminate against, you know, anybody. Mind is a mind is a mind. Just grows, cause and effect. So we don't go too much in this worship of gurus. When you go for refuge in Buddhism, what do you go to refuge to? The Buddha? The Dhamma? And Ajahn Brahm? No. Don't ever do that. That's dangerous. That's where it really gets into guru worship. And, you know, if you give too much guru worship to someone, they think they're special. And they think they're beyond sort of ordinary laws. So they can abuse you, have sex with you, strip you of your assets, and all sorts of other stuff which in religion causes a huge amount of problems. Because sometimes you exalt a leader way above what they deserve. It's just a mind, that's all. Just a jitter. So, in this way, your own jitter, other people's jitters, are the same nature as yours. So if you find a guru who said, oh, your jitter, my jitter, the same nature, it says so in the Satipatthana. Or else you abide, what causes the arising of the jitter? It's just nama rupa, it's, you know, stuff you're aware of. And the objects of consciousness, when the objects of consciousness cease, then the citta ceases. We abide contemplating the citta's causal nature of both arising and ceasing. Well, it's mindful, it's just a citta, that's all. Impermanent, suffering, and not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. It is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential to liberation. It's just a citta, that's all, just a process. So you're not entangled with a citta. You abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world, especially not clinging to a citta. That is how you're mindful of the mind. Number four, mindful of mind objects. How are you mindful of mind objects? First of all, the five hindrances. You're mindful of mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. When there was wanting regarding the five senses, this is Karmachanda. You are mindful that there was such wanting. When there's no wanting regarding the five senses, you are mindful there's no such wanting. You also understand how such wanting arises, how to let go of such wanting, and how such wanting doesn't arise again. That's, you know, the first hindrance, the loke abhijja, otherwise known as Karmachanda. There being aversion in you. There being dullness and drowsiness in you. There being restlessness and remorse in you. When there was doubt in you. All these, when there is aversion in you, when there is dullness, when there is restlessness, you can't really know them well. That's because they're dull. You're restless. But when afterwards you can understand, oh yeah, that was dullness, that was restlessness. And when there was doubt in you, you are mindful that there was such doubt. When there was no such doubt, you are mindful that there is no doubt. You also understand how such doubt arises, how to let go of doubt, and how doubt doesn't arise again. So now, we have a little digression here of the five hindrances and the Buddha's similes for them. Number one, the wanting. Suppose you took out a loan and your business was successful. Then you repaid that loan and there was enough left over for your own enjoyment and for that of your family. As a result, you would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose you were very ill and you couldn't eat or sleep and had no strength. Later, however, you recovered, could eat and sleep again, and you regained your strength. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. Or suppose you were a slave, dependent upon others, unable to go where you want, and then later you were released from slavery, independent of others, able to go where you want. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. Ah, yes. I don't like prison. I escaped. Or suppose you were imprisoned and later were released, safe and secure, with no loss to your property. As a result, you'd be glad and full of joy. Or the last one, doubt. Or suppose you had to travel along a dangerous road, across a wilderness, but later you'd pass through that wilderness, safe and secure, with no loss to your property. As a result, you'd be glad and full of joy. They usually use a wilderness. I gave the simile the other day of in the desert. And no, it wasn't desert, in the mountains, in the mist. There was the other simile of the man lost in the desert, which I usually tell at this time. There's a man lost in the desert. And you know what it's like in the desert? It's really hot. There's no sources of water. And a really heavy baking sun. And after a while, and he didn't know where he was. And he lost for days, dehydrated, maybe sunstroke. And as he was crawling, he couldn't walk anymore, he's crawling, just, you know, going to be next, close to death soon. And in the horizon, he saw a shimmering on the horizon. As if there was, you know, it was different than the rest of the horizon. It was, looked like something was coming towards him. And of course, he thought it was just a mirage, which happens in the hot desert. But as it came closer, he was looking, and it looked like there was some sort of vehicle, you know, with some, something pulling the vehicle and even a person in the front. And he thought, this time I'm just imagining these things. The heat, the dehydration has got to my brain. And as it came closer, he said, I am going crazy. Because he noticed it was a dog sleigh pulled by husky dogs with an Inuit, an Eskimo in the front in furs in the middle of the desert. And he said, I've gone crazy, I'm mad. But then as it came closer, he could actually hear the husky dogs barking. And one of them was licking his face. And it was a real Inuit Eskimo was actually driving a dog sled. It was real. He said, oh, I'm saved, I've been rescued. Thank you so much. I've been lost in this desert for days. And the Eskimo and the husky dogs, the Eskimo and furs, he said, and you think you're lost. Sorry, I can't avoid jokes. So too, when these five hindrances were present, you look back upon them as a debt, wanting something. It's like you take out a loan of your happiness. You have to give up happiness and strive, strive, strive. Sometimes it gets repaid, sometimes it doesn't. So that's the thing with wanting. Or the other, this was a Western philosopher, I forget who it was, who noted when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Very brilliant. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So, you got to Jhana Grove, listening to a talk, full tummy, nice place to rest tonight. What do you want? I want nimittas. And so you get a nice nimitta. And are you happy? No, you want something more. You want jhana. So you get a jhana. I want a second jhana. You get a second jhana. I want sotapanna. And then you get sotapanna. Oh, and you get arahat. I want psychic powers. I want to be able to fly through. I'm fed up with flying Singapore Airlines. I just want to sort of just appear in Singapore. Just like a strong person flexes their arms. You disappear from China Grove and you appear in Singapore. I want to travel. I want to be able to read the minds of my boss and find out what he's really up to. I want to read the minds and know his passwords so I can hack his emails. I want... No, don't do stuff like that. It's wanting has no end to it. So how much do you really need? You ain't got to go to work. I've got to go to work. But there are times when you sit down and have no wanting at all. So you can enjoy what you already have. You worked hard to get money, time off, to come to Jhana Grove. Now you're here. Enjoy it. Don't destroy it by wanting something more. Have these wonderful holidays where all wanting stops. You worked hard for this. Now you're here. I worked hard to build this place. Now it's here. So I'm going to enjoy it. So this is where you look upon them as you're in debt if you want something. But you just enjoy what you have when you don't want anything. It's a disease, it's aversion. It's itchy. I don't like my body, my pain. It is like a disease, not wanting. Wherever you go, thinking that if you change your partner, if you change your job, if you change your body, if you change your gender, if you change your teacher, everything will be okay. Just aversion follows you around. It's expecting what the world can't give you. Or dullness and drowsiness, being in a prison. They're contracted. You can't just go anywhere. You're dull. And slavery, restlessness and remorse. Just the will, always telling you what to do and how to do it. Come on, stop wasting time. There's only a few days left in Jhana Grove. Come on. You're a slave to that will. It doesn't let you go. I'm going to let go. No, don't let go. That's like having a master or a mistress always telling you what to do. And of course, a dangerous road across the wilderness. But when these five hindrances have been abandoned, you regard them as freedom from debt. You don't owe anything. You're healthy with no aversion. You're released from prison. Not dull. Freedom from slavery. The mind can go wherever it's wanted. Not told what to do. To achieve something. To improve. To do better. Come on, you can do better than this. Don't believe that. Already told you about the trees in the forest. They're all beautiful. They don't have to improve. Would you like to improve the trees in this forest? Straighten them all up. No way. So, and reaching a land of safety, you're safe. So that's the five hindrances, getting to really know what they are. Because they're important as mind objects. You focus on them like a scientist. That's your experiment. The hindrances, what are they? Where do they come from? Why? So you can overcome them, let them go. When those five hindrances are gone, no wanting, no aversion, no svasana torpa. You're energized. You're no sort of restlessness. Your mind is poised. And then, just like I was saying this morning about walking up the Kingsbury Drive, you stop. Not restless. And amazing just what you see. Incredible sort of things when you stop and still and let nature show you what she has to show. And a land of safety. People are always afraid. I mentioned fear many times, and there's so much of what we do is out of fear. Fear of what people think of us. Fear of failure. Fear of disease and pain. I don't know if I can handle this. You reach a land of safety. No more fear. Imagine that. Fear totally gone. So anyway, that's the land of safety. So when that happens, in its place come the seven enlightenment factors. So these are opposites of one another, like night and day. So when the hindrances go, the seven enlightenment factors start to appear. So, or you are mindful of mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you, you understand it's present. Yeah, I'm mindful. I understand what mindfulness is. As an experience, not as a theory. But when the enlightenment factor of mindfulness was not present in you, you understand it was absent. You also understand how there comes to be the arising of the absent, enlightenment factor of mindfulness. And importantly, how it comes to fulfillment by development. Yeah, there's mindfulness. Even a thief is mindful. Really mindful. When a thief opens the door, no one hears them. When they walk into your house, they don't make any noise. Otherwise, the people in the house will know the thief is there. A thief can come and go. Or like, you know, we had one monk years ago. He was a Gurkha from Nepal. We had a Gurkha fellow. He was a monk. And he told us that the Gurkhas, their slogan was, if the Gurkhas come into your house or into your barracks, because they're soldiers, you don't know they've come or they've gone until the morning, when you shake your head and it falls off. That's the way you know the Gurkhas have been. And we used to tell that story and tell this to the Gurkha. He said, what's he doing as a monk? Because he was in the accounts department of the Gurkhas. He never fought at all, but he was a really good accountant. Even the army needs accountants and dentists and stuff. He was a really good fellow. Anyway, oh, I don't know what happened to him. Anyway, he was a really nice fellow. Nepalese Gurkha. I think he went over to, I haven't seen him for a long time, we went over to around Nepal actually to, you know, see if we could start a Buddhist monastery over there. Don't know what happened to him. Anyway, you're mindful of mind objects and how they come to fulfillment. So the mindfulness, with a bit of kindness, it starts to get, you know, kindness makes it enjoyable to be mindful of your body. But it also is stillness as well. Then the mindfulness really takes off. To see a world in a grain of sand. To see the beautiful, beautiful wood. I know sometimes in meditation people start smelling fragrant smells in the hall. I don't know about you, my mindfulness must be very strong. I can smell chocolate. Oh, it's no, sometimes you're in the hall and you're meditating and you can actually smell like lotus scent or sandalwood. And no one is using scents or using that as their soap or whatever. It's just there and you think, wow, what's happening here? Is my meditation so good that heavenly beings are visiting me? But it's not that at all. It's the same phenomena as the most delicious baked bean I've ever tasted. Your mind becomes so strong. Your mindfulness, whatever it sees, feels, tastes, even knows, becomes delightful. It's one of the the reasons why developing mindfulness develops a very happy mind. And anything is just, wow, great, beautiful. That is, that's an unworldly happiness. So, when you have such mindfulness, we come up to happiness, I've rushed ahead a bit here, of exploring the Dhamma is present in you. Now, sometimes that's called contemplating the Dhamma. And contemplating for many people means thinking, giving things names. So, when I give the demonstration of what does exploring the Dhamma mean, this Dhamma vicaya, which is the Pali for the second enlightenment factor, I usually use an example, an exercise. What am I holding here in my hand? Yes, what else? Keep on looking. What else can you name? What else? Okay, that's contemplating it. Now, when all those names, which are the bricks and mortar of thinking, are all gone, now have a look. And your mind just goes into it and explores it. Not with names, because the names are just trying to capture it. Now you can actually see things you may have never seen before. As you allow the mind to just be mindful, be still. And don't try to pass any test and get the right answers. No right answer, no wrong answer. You explore it. Your mind, allow the mind to go into it. Just like you explore the grounds of jhana growth. You explore. You don't know what you're going to find. And that exploration is what we mean here. You're mindful and you let the mind explore. If you think you know, then you never find out what's in here. That's the trouble with knowledge. It thinks it's completed the task and doesn't go any further. Given it a name, put it in a box, ticked it, and then you go on to something else. So that was a exercise I gave at the 2 years ago at the World Computer Congress in Daejeon in Korea. I gave the keynote speech. And a keynote is once the president and the host give their welcome to everybody, then the keynote speech. And I always have something a bit of out of the box, a bit different. So I got up there and I said, they wonder, what the heck is a Buddhist monk doing here? Who, you know, keeps pressing the wrong buttons on something as simple as this. I'm not an IT expert. But this was one of the exercises. Held up a plastic bottle, what is this? Did the same exercise. Innovation. Seeing further than other people have seen. Going deeper into something. Okay, all you guys, girls, you have all the names. Once those names are finished, now keep looking. That's exploring. Mindful exploration. You find things you haven't seen before. So that's the enlightenment factor of exploring a Dhamma. Enlightenment factor of energy. You know, it gets boring when it's a test. You know, you can just see the person next to you, see what they're saying. There's this called cheating. That's one of the reasons I didn't like tests at school. Sometimes you're sitting next to your best friend, and you're competing against your best friend. That didn't make sense to me. Reminds me of the story of these two kids. They were in the same class. Actually, they were no twins. In the same class, and the homework, English homework, was write an essay about your dog. And when they handed in their essay, the teachers sent them to the principal, you've been cheating. What do you mean cheating? Well, your essay is exactly the same, word for word. And the two kids says, well, it's the same dog. I love silly jokes. Sometimes it balances the subtlety of the Dhamma. So when you have energy, it just happens. You get interested in what you're doing. And the energy, especially mindful, you start to really wake up. And then joy starts coming up. The happiness factor. It's really fun meditating. You really get really joyful. Wonderful time. And then tranquility comes. Bodily and mental tranquility. A sense of contentment. If you're happy, joyful, you don't want anything. You're happy being here. So you're tranquil. What was really powerful when I first saw this was to have a tranquil a body which doesn't move. It has to be happy. If you haven't got the happiness there, the joy, you can hold the body still, but it's just so tiring. And you can't do it for very long. But if you're very happy, you're sitting here, really just maybe just watching a delightful breath, you can sit here just absolutely still, not moving, not forced. It's just default state, because joy means you're not looking for anything, you don't need to change anything. This is more than good enough. And so from the joy comes the tranquility of body and mind, and from that comes the stillness. Really deep stillness. Stillness like you've never experienced before, when nothing moves. Stillness upon stillness. It's like the whole universe pauses. The wheels stop and the engine pauses. Perfect stillness. That is so cool. And afterwards, equanimity. Understand it's present. The enlightenment factor of equanimity or contentment was not present in you. Understand it was absent. You understand how there comes to be arising of the absent enlightenment factor of equanimity and how it comes to fulfillment by development. That's the equanimity. And afterwards, you get five components of existence and four noble truths. But, you know, that's, I'll pass over those. Six sense basis, because it seems they were actually added afterwards. But anyway, the summary of mind objects. In these ways you're aware of mind objects, you're aware that others' mind objects are the same nature as yours, you abide aware of both your own and others' mind objects. If you had totally unique mind objects, I wouldn't understand what was going on in your head and would not be able to do any teaching for you. You know, because yesterday it was Ajahn Brahmani's birthday. Yesterday was a real birthday. So yesterday evening, you know, his father called from Norway. His name is Alf. And he's got a nickname amongst the monks now, because Alf apparently was alien life form. Ajahn Brahmani's father knows us. Oh, it's alien life form calling. Apparently that was a TV show or something. Yeah, Alf. That's Ajahn Brahmani's dad. Anyway, you're aware of mind objects, you're aware that others' mind objects are the same nature as yours, no difference. You're aware of both your own and others' mind objects. Your five hindrances, my five hindrances, the alignment factors of the Buddhas and yours are all the same. Or else you're quite aware of what causes the arising of mind objects. You abide the mind objects of the nature to cease when attention ceases. You abide contemplating mind objects, cause and nature of birth arise. It's just mind objects, that's all. Whereas mindfulness is just mind objects. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. So you turn off the mind. Click. You lose your mind. In English, that's you lose your mind means you go crazy. But in Buddhism, you lose your mind means you parinibbana. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how you are mindful of mind objects. Samya Satipatthana says, in reference to this, it was said, the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way for the realization of nibbana. And coming in the next episode of The Word of the Buddha is the same as what we just done, but just using Anapanasati Sutta as Satipatthana. Just to make the point that there is no difference. And this is according to how the Buddha taught. So unfortunately that can't be tomorrow. So it will be happening, because I already mentioned we're doing the Purana in the afternoon ceremony. So that will be coming, what day is it tomorrow, Wednesday? On Thursday. Yes, good. So Thursday we're doing the Brahma Sutra, Anapanasati, and Friday, the Jhanas. Good day for Jhanas, Friday? Okay. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay, have a wonderful afternoon. Oh, it's tea time now, isn't it, for you? What?
Showing them the cover.
Okay. So, one of the reasons my nickname is Ajahn Donut, because a donut is round, it's sweet, and it's holy. Very good. Very good. Okay, so have a... What's inside?
Oh.
Da-da-da.
Inside are all the...
Retreatants. Every one of them. Goodness gracious. Very good. With Mega Method, Jhana Grover, Tubby Retreatants. Excellent.